of lids, crit, creator, Dusham, of the eyes. Translation. When you go off to the forest during the day, a tiny fraction of a second becomes like a millennium for us, because we cannot see you. And even when we can eagerly look upon your beautiful face, so lovely with its adornment of curling locks, our pleasure is hindered by our eyelids, which are fashioned by the foolish creator. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prastaya Bhutalaya Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Samaniti Namane Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pacharani Nivrishesha Shunyavadi Paschachita Satanami Mukam Koruti Vachalam Pangam Langayate Grim Yat Kripa Tam Aham Vande Shri Guru Dhinatananam. So, here we are in the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, discussing probably or definitely the most esoteric and complicated and difficult to understand aspect of bhakti yoga or Krishna consciousness, the concept of separation, especially the separation of the gopis, because there's different levels of separation, which we'll discuss a little bit. But the separation of the gopis, and more particular, this particular separation of the gopis, just to give a little bit of a frame where we're reading from in the Bhagavatam, the gopis were called in the dead of night in the autumn season. It was beautiful outside, and the moon was shining. Jamuna was glowing in the moonlight, and Krishna blew his flute or played his flute and called the gopis to a rasa dance. And so the gopis left everything. They left their families, they left their babies, they left everything, and they ran into the forest without really considering anything. Some of them were described as to, you know, barely, their clothes were on wrong, and their earrings were on upside down, and so many different things, because they had neglected to take care of what would be considered material business, and they just went to Krishna. So then they got to Krishna, and they were dancing with Krishna, and they got a little bit satisfied, proud, oh, now we're with Krishna, we're so fortunate, we're with Krishna, and then Krishna disappeared. So how he disappeared, with whom he disappeared, what happened when he disappeared, that's a whole other couple of chapters. But here we have the gopis lamenting over the fact that Krishna disappeared. They had him. They were dancing with him. Their desire to be with him was being fulfilled, and now he's gone. And so this feeling of separation, Prabhupada describes that if you have nothing, then you dream about having it, and you might feel some separation about not having it, but it's not the same as if you've had it and then you lose it. Then the feeling of separation is much more intense if you had it and then you lose it. But even more intense of having it and losing it is having it, losing it, getting it back, and then being afraid of losing it again. And so we have this whole experience with the gopis of every day seeing Krishna going to the forest, lamenting his absence, aspiring for his association. And it's particularly aspiring for his association alone and not around other people. And having his exclusive attention, because one thing about this rasa dance is that although Krishna was apparently one person, he expanded in such a way that every member of the gopi the gopis that came to that rasa dance, they were all convinced that Krishna was there just for them. And so they were all relishing that moment with great joy. Finally, it had come, and then he disappeared. Now, to back up a little bit, because this concept of separation, although extremely pivotal in our devotional line, is not to be taken lightly, and it has to be considered with gravity. Otherwise, it can be extremely dangerous and misleading. And you know, Srila Prabhupada in many places cautions us about entering into, you know, the non-devotees say, fools rush in where angels fear to tread. So this area of understanding the separation of the gopis, the relationship, the loving desire of the gopis to be with Krishna, is certainly a place where angels tread very, very cautiously. Actually, true angels or saints, they don't feel qualified to tread there, although they may tread there because their mind is so attracted to the leelas of Krishna, and particularly Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his exhibition of what that loving relationship between Radha and Krishna is. Still, they tread there with great caution. And Srila Prabhupada, understanding our perhaps lack of a spiritual advancement, maybe not being quite ready to enter into that, and also understanding that we, perhaps by our cultural upbringing, we always want to be number one. Did you ever notice that? Number two doesn't work. Number one is we have to excel. We have to go to the top of the class. And so we always want whatever someone says is the highest, that's where we belong. We think, right? That if it's the highest, I must be. Your Brahman is the highest, I must be a Brahman. Renunciation is the highest, I must be renounced. And the separation of the gopis and Krishna is the highest form of love. I should completely relish that because that's the highest. That's my birthright. Unfortunately, in this case, it's not our birthright. Or I should say it is our birthright, but with entering it with caution over time and with the prerequisites necessary in order to achieve a real definite understanding. I want to skip ahead a couple of verses just to take a look at what the gopis are all about. Because sometimes when we hear this separation and I want to be with you, and we think of love songs. We have so many love songs. There's always love songs about how I want to be with you, and, you know, then when you go away, I cry and lament, and I just want to be with you until I find somebody else, and then I get with them, and then it's okay, and then I forget about you, and you go find somebody else, and that's cool too, no problem. But this relationship with Krishna and the gopis isn't like that. And it isn't like that on a very fundamental level. A very fundamental level, because each of us in the material world is looking out for number one, and number one is not you, number one is me. So no matter how much I may profess deep, passionate love for you, really what I'm talking about is it feels good to me. And so as long as you make me feel good, as long as there's a relationship between you and I which is satisfying something in me, then I'm hanging around. It's cool. It works. But as soon as that number one is not being satisfied somehow or other, then I walk. And that only doesn't only apply to me. It applies to the other person in the equation too. So you've got two number ones in the equation, both thinking that their happiness is the ultimate issue in this relationship. And if either one of them finds themselves unfulfilled, they look for another person who can fulfill their desire. But the relationship on a very fundamental level of the gopis and Krishna, or of devotees and Krishna, is based on a completely different premise. And that premise is, I want to satisfy Krishna. I want to serve Krishna. I want to make Krishna happy. And the reason I want to be with him, in this case, the reason I want to be with him, the reason I want to dance with him, the reason I want to have intimate relationship with him is because I want to serve him. Now, mixed in with that, which is already difficult to understand when we're on the material platform, is the idea that Krishna doesn't need anything. He doesn't need anything. There's nothing that we have that he needs except one thing. And that's that devotion, that bhakti, which we bring to the table. And Krishna appreciates us or our relationship with him to the degree that that bhakti is deep. If our love for him, our desire to please him, to satisfy him is deep, then Krishna reciprocates with that. And that only. And because he sees that in us, he reciprocates by accepting our devotion for our sake, not for his sake. He doesn't need anything. He's complete in himself. But because he loves us and sees how much we love him, he reciprocates with that love by accepting our devotion. And we benefit from his acceptance of that devotion. So here you have the gopis who are at first seemingly feeling a little proud. Oh, we got Krishna, finally we're alone with him. No one's around, it's beautiful out, the moon is shining, everything's perfect, and then Krishna disappears, and they're lamenting. But they're not lamenting on the normal platform that, ah, shucks, you know, I wasn't completely satisfied yet. I wanted a few more minutes, or a few more hours, or a few more millenniums, and then I would be satisfied, and then he could go. No, the feeling is, Krishna wanted me to serve him, was allowing me to serve him in a loving relationship, and now he's left and I can't serve him anymore. And because I can't serve him anymore, I'm feeling very sad. I'm feeling very sad and I'm lamenting that I'm not able to show my devotion or offer him my devotion. Whatever little devotion I may have, I really want to offer that to him, and I can't. So in text 19, which is just a few verses down from the one we just read, you can see a little bit more the mood in which the gopis are lamenting over Krishna's absence. He's,
we have it on the screen.
Oh, cool. Okay. Dearly beloved, your lotus feet are so soft that we place them gently on our breasts, fearing that your feet will be hurt. So I'm not putting them intimately with me because it feels good and I really like it and it's cool and it's from the Kama Sutra and I think it's going to really satisfy my material desires, but I'm doing it because I'm fearing that your feet will be hurt, and my desire to please you, excuse me, our life rests only in you. Our minds, therefore, are filled with anxiety that your tender feet might be wounded by pebbles as you roam around the forest path. So here you went away from us because we were at fault. We were feeling a little proud. You went away, and now you're walking barefoot, and maybe you're hurting your feet. And we wanted to make sure that your feet were never hurt. We wanted to put, and even in other places, the gopis complain or fear that their breasts are too hard, and that even Krishna putting his feet there may not be comfortable for him. So this feeling, this intense feeling, it's hard to even describe because it's so far from my level of understanding. I only can even begin to understand it by understanding it from my spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada. But to explain it is even more difficult. To help us understand, we can look back at the beginnings of the feelings of separation in devotees that perhaps we can relate to a little bit more. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the first canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, because in the 10th canto now, this 10th canto is an achievement. It's like getting your PhD and trying to go directly from grade school into the PhD classes. It's going to be hard, because the information is so above our level of comprehension. But on the other hand, if we develop the adhikara, the privilege of being able to enter into the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, we have to have already understood everything else. Now, I know we've all read it, probably, or you've heard lectures on the different themes or topics going up to this 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam and the topic of separation. But still, how many times can you read Bhagavad Gita even, which is considered, you know, the beginning, Bhagavad Gita, Bhagavad Gita. I already have a Bhakti Shastri degree, you know, it's over Bhagavad Gita. I'm into the other stuff. But actually in our line, the understanding is everything we need to know is in each one of the books. My godbrother, Shutakirti Prabhu, who spent quite some time being Prabhupada's servant, often comments that Prabhupada told him in relation to many books, if you just read this book, that's all you need to read. You don't need to know anything else. And he would tell them him that about Bhagavad Gita. He would tell them him that about Nectar of Devotion. He would tell them that about Krishna book. He would tell them that about so many books. If you just read this book, that's all you need to know. And Prabhupada told us, I've given you the, when he wrote the first canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, he came with those Bhagavatams from India. They were printed in a hurry, but they were also printed in India. And they were printed in India almost 50 years ago. So the combination of all those things made them full of apparent errors. You know, they were written in pidgin English, and they were not edited completely, and there was no word processor, no computer. So it was, you know, all painstakingly done by Srila Prabhupada by his hand. And when Prabhupada brought those three books, those three volumes of the first canto, he told us, if you just understand these three books, you know everything. I've given you everything now. You have everything you need to know just in these three books. So then, how do we understand that? Where do we begin to understand this in light of the fact that everything we need to know is in the first three canto, of the first three volumes, or the first canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam? So we understand that Krishna is sitting in our heart. Tesham satati yuktanam bhajatam priti purvakam didami buddhi yogantam yenamam apyantite. So Krishna is sitting in our heart, and from him he gives us the knowledge that we need, the love. He clears the dirt out of our heart, and he inspires us. He gives us the knowledge we need, and especially this knowledge, this intense loving relationship with Krishna, this understanding of our particular loving exchange with Krishna, is something that we achieve by Krishna's mercy. It comes by Krishna's mercy. We do our part, so there's effort on our part, but at the same time, Krishna sees that and reciprocates with that in many, many different ways, many ways we may take somewhat for granted. So if we go back to the first canto, we first experience the separation in the exchanges of the Pandavas with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And specifically, after the war is over, and after, the enemies have so been subdued, more or less, and Yudhisthira is rightfully enthroned, and everybody is cool. It's all okay now, or relatively okay. And so Krishna says, okay, I'm gone. I'm out of here. I'm going back to Dwarka. And so Kunti comes, and she speaks her prayers to him, and she expresses in her prayers, wait a minute. We experienced so many calamities with so many problems, and you were there for us. And now you're going away. And you know what? I'd rather have the problems than have you leave. Because the real problem is that you leave. That's the real problem. The real problem is that somehow my consciousness is not fixed on you. Is that I'm not thinking about you every minute of the day and every minute of the night, 24/7. That's the real problem. And if you go away, there's a chance that I might not remember you. If things become too easy, I might not remember you. If there are no calamities, no dangers, if I'm not feeling that I need to depend on you, then I might forget you. I not only might I forget you, but I might become artificially independent. I might think that it's okay. I'm okay. I can handle it. And this is the common thought in the culture that we're being raised in, is that we can handle it. If you get a degree, if you get enough money, if you get the right spouse, if you get the right iPad, if you get the right, you know, digital paraphernalia, you can handle anything. And if you can't really handle it, at least you could look like you can handle it. And so this arrogance, this thought of being able to handle it, is the number one thing that prevents us from understanding this separation. Because this feeling of separation is dependent on total humility, on the total understanding that I can't do anything without the mercy of Krishna. I can't do anything without the mercy of Krishna. In our spiritual life, in our material life, we are seeking happiness. We're happiness seekers. And actually, even at the very beginning, when Prabhupada first came to New York, some people asked him, what is the purpose of this Krishna consciousness? And Prabhupada said, to become happy. Because everybody wants to become happy. No one wants to become sad. Everything that everyone does, even the stupidest things. In my classes, when I teach in Mayapur, if your cell phone goes off, you have to buy sweets for everybody in the class. See, you want to be happy. That's why you want sweets. So we want to be happy, and we're in pursuit of happiness. We in our constitution, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It's interesting how they say the pursuit of happiness. It's almost an indication. It's like trying to pin the tail on a donkey. You're just looking for happiness. You have the right to look for happiness. You'll never find it, but you have a right to look for it. And so we spend our whole life chasing the American dream in pursuit of happiness. That's what the Constitution offers us, a pursuit of happiness. Prabhupada offers us the opportunity to find happiness. Krishna consciousness is the opportunity to find happiness. But in order to find happiness, we have to stop pursuing it, which is a kind of a conundrum in our spiritual understanding. If you want to understand Krishna consciousness, you have to understand that the key to happiness is that you stop looking for it. You stop pursuing it. And instead of looking for happiness, you look for service to Krishna and service to the devotees and service to the spiritual master. And in serving them, whatever we get becomes happiness. We become satisfied with it. We become satisfied in our core because Krishna's got the whole world in his hands. And so we don't have to worry about it. But we do worry about it. And as long as we worry about it, we consider that the world owes us happiness. And so this generation of people, I think, what is it called? The entitlement? The generation of entitlement? This generation, they're calling, in colloquial psychological circles, they're calling it the generation of entitlement, that everybody thinks that the world owes them a living. Or the world owes them something. The world owes them happiness. And very quickly, they discover that everything the world has to offer doesn't provide them with the happiness they want. So they find happiness, but that happiness is what we call chapalasukha. It's there one minute, it's gone the next. And then we pursue it in a different way. We look for it in a different brand. We try to find it in a different store. We try to get a different size. We try to gain weight, lose weight, make big muscles, get rid of them. We're always looking for something to give us happiness. People who, at a young age, realize profoundly that the material world is not going to provide them with the happiness they want, often kill themselves because they don't know where else to look. And they see in this material world that pursuit of happiness is a vain pursuit. It's like running after a carrot. There's a poster that is going around. Sometimes I see it on Facebook of a man, and he's naked, but he's quite muscular, and he's got this thing on his head, a circle with a wire, and there's a carrot hanging from it. Right, and he's running after material happiness. That's what he's running after, just like we talk about a jackass running after a carrot. So that pursuit of happiness, when we realize its futility, it's very depressing. People are depressed. So what do? They take pills to get rid of the depression, or they just end their lives to get rid of depression, or they continue to play the game and continue to keep chasing. So we have to get that out of our consciousness. And it's not so easy because we live in a consumer society, and the religious basis of the society we live in is you're entitled to happiness. You're entitled to the pursuit of happiness. And that's the antithesis of what it takes to come to the level of the separation that the gopis are feeling in their relationship with Krishna, or any devotee, really. So we Bhagavad Gita describes to us, or lets us understand, that in order to begin feeling separation from transcendental realization, we have to get some knowledge. We have to get transcendental knowledge. And that transcendental knowledge begins with, you're not that body, you're a spirit soul. And even that's just the beginning, because it's not good enough to just know who you aren't. It is essential to know who you are. So often we hear we're not that body, and we understand that we're a spiritual being. We're a spiritual being. But what the purpose of that spiritual being is, who that spiritual being is, what the identity of that spiritual being is, how the happiness of that spiritual being is realized, is something we must understand. And we have to understand it from transcendental knowledge, from studying the Shastra, from hearing from devotees, from engaging in devotional service, because Krishna says that knowledge comes from within and also from without. It comes from him as Antaryami in the heart. It comes from the guru outside. It comes from the association of devotees. And that knowledge is the basis that allows us to move forward and develop a loving relationship with Krishna, and to understand what we're missing in that relationship, to understand why we should feel separation from that relationship. Not because it'll make us happy, but because it'll make Krishna happy. Because our devotion to Krishna will make us happy, will make him happy. And in him becoming happy, we automatically become satisfied. So Srila Prabhupada, he kind of unlocked that, understanding from the very beginning. The Bhagavatam unlocks it from the very beginning. If you look at the first verse of the Bhagavatam, it's described dharma projita kaitravo cha paramo nimatsaranam. So kaitrava dharma, that the Srimad Bhagavatam kicks out all cheating religion. Why cheating religion? What is cheating religion? Cheating religion tells you, love God and you'll get a new car. Love God and you'll become rich and famous. If God becomes happy, he'll give you a house by the sea and a new DVD, Swaminjai Jagadisha Hari. If God loves you, that love will manifest in a Ferrari. If God loves you, that love will manifest in good health. That's why, you know, it's weird when bad things happen to good people. Because good people worship God, and God should be reciprocal. What's wrong with God? Why isn't he being reciprocal? Why are you getting trouble when you should get all the troubles cleared away? That's cheating religion. And Bhagavatam kicks that out. So from the very beginning of the Bhagavatam, we hear, if you want to enter into the loving relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, you've got to stop looking for number one. You've got to start looking at the real number one, which is Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And by making him happy and him satisfied, then you'll be okay. And when you realize how far from that you are, when you realize how easily you fall into the trap of making yourself happy by your own endeavor, then you begin to feel separation. You begin to feel separation, understanding how long the road is back to the spiritual world, and how difficult it is to tread, how careful you need to be, how much you need to depend on the Supreme Lord and his devotees and your spiritual master and these shastras in order to keep ourselves fixed and moving directly on the path so that we can achieve the ultimate separation or the ultimate feeling of separation, where we truly understand that Krishna is, serving Krishna is everything. And whatever we get from that will give us the ultimate happiness that we're looking for. But we don't need to look for it. And it's almost difficult to talk about, because in order to understand it, you have to say it. But the reality is, you can't look for happiness. You can't be looking for happiness. And we're so driven by that pursuit that it's very difficult of us to be faithful. I do sometimes this exercise where I ask people to stand up in pairs, and then I ask one person to fall into the arms of the other. And it's very difficult to do that. It's very difficult to fall. If you put a foot between you and the other person and you just face the back of you to them and you just ask yourself or someone asks you, let yourself fall. You'll find that you can't fall. Your leg will come out, your arm will go out, you'll look around, you check out the person first, make sure he's tall enough and big enough and you're not fatter than they are, and you know, go through this whole mental thing, well, is this person going to be able to catch me? And your mental state will prevent you from falling. And this is what happens in our spiritual life, because spiritual life, surrender, is about falling. It's about falling into Krishna's hands and letting him do whatever and being confident that whatever is just what you need. Whatever it is, it's just what you need. And so being able to fall in Krishna's hands means that we don't check it out. We just fall. And that's not so easy. So it takes practice, it takes development of transcendental knowledge and the pursuit of spiritual advancement, which comes from service and association, both of which you have here, and the willingness to walk before you can run. Because if you try to run before you know how to walk, you'll find yourself in a very precarious situation. So I have 6 minutes left before we have to chant that prayer that we all like to chant. And so I'm going to stop and ask if there's any questions, because this is a very complicated topic. Yes?
I have a comment about the entitlement.
Uh-huh.
I heard psychologists are calling this the entitlement generation. Mm-hmm. I heard that it's a psychology mentality to think that the world owes me a living.
Psychopath. Great. We live in a society of psychopaths. Doesn't that make you feel good?
I'm not sure exactly what my question is. Oh, Haribol.
Please accept mine.
You mentioned something that touched me. You mentioned that young people, when they realize the material world has no happiness, they take their lives. And when I was in law school, I had, in 1 year, two young men
committed suicide.
They contacted me on Facebook at two different times. And I was in law school, so I didn't have time to preach to them. And they had dated women in my family, and young women in my family. And so I was like, I don't know why they're contacting me. And then they committed suicide, and so I realized that they, you know, they saw that I was a Hare Krishna, and they were looking for, you know, something, and so, anyway, that was difficult, so I can see it's true that's pretty common now for young people who are intelligent to not know what to do, so they just take their lives. So.
Yeah, actually, Srila Prabhupada saw us in that way. When he came to America, he saw us in an emergency situation, in a very dangerous situation. And he always repeatedly conveyed to us that the house was on fire and we need to get out. You know, and we need to get out and we need to take as many people with us as possible. He wasn't passive about that. He was very, it was a feeling of emergency. And Srila Prabhupada very much had that feeling of emergency, that he was moving very fast, partly because he was an older person when he came to the West. He had already waited. He actually lamented in tears in one of his Vyasa Puja offerings that he had waited too long to follow the order of his spiritual master. And now that he came, he was so old, and that he didn't think he was going to live long enough to really do what he could have done if he had come earlier. And so he's handed that baton to us to have that same sense of urgency, to feel impelled that we're not comfortable. Our line of devotional life. Lord Chaitanya, beginning with Lord Chaitanya, we see that he says, I have so many fruits to distribute, but I can't distribute them alone. It's not possible. So I need help. And then you see Bhaktivinoda Thakur and his whole Namahat program and the marketplace of the holy name and appointing each of us a different responsibility in maintaining that marketplace. And so, but the marketplace, the fact that we are giving the holy name or selling the holy name, and the price is our desire to have it. Lord Chaitanya, Prabhu Nityananda in particular, is the distributor of that holy name. And all he wants is your desire to have it, and then he'll distribute it freely. And then Prabhupada says that if Lord Chaitanya, he was the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and he said he couldn't do it alone, I'm an ordinary person, how can I do it alone? Therefore, my spiritual master has sent all of you to help me to distribute love of God. So he felt that tremendous sense of urgency. And we really need to be careful, because sometimes we look around us and we see people that look like they're having a good time. We see people that look like they're enjoying. They have a lot of money. They have a fancy car. They have all the gadgets. They have a good-looking girlfriend or a handsome boyfriend. And they're laughing. And they're behaving in a way that makes our mind think that they're enjoying. And maybe they're enjoying more than me. And why is it that I have to live such an austere life? Maybe I joined the wrong movement, you know. But we have to remember that Krishna consciousness is looking for a happiness that's eternal. That's not Kaitava Dharma. That's not cheating. That's not telling us that we're going to have a lifetime warranty when our lifetime may only be a day or 2 days. We don't know how long our lifetime is. But we know that everything in this lifetime is temporary. And there's no thing in this lifetime that isn't temporary. So we have to keep the philosophy of Krishna consciousness in the forefront of our thought. Otherwise, we run the risk of becoming enamored by the material energy. And Prabhupada was very cautious about that. And if you listen to his lectures, you'll see that he speaks about that more than he speaks about anything. That he, you know, to keep remembering this, that the material world is not a place for a gentleman or a gentlewoman. Yes, Prabhu. Humility.
So the most exalted devotees.
It's not only that he considers it knowledge, it's prerequisite for all the other ones.
Very, very important. And so I'll never be able to really to obtain real attraction for Krishna, maybe or a deep bhakti without it. But I'm reading and understanding that even the most exalted devotees, the gopis, so what hope do I have for every cultivating
world? Keep thinking like that. That's the key to success. That we always see somebody else's... one of my godbrothers asked Prabhupada in my presence basically the same question, worded slightly differently. And Prabhupada said, you should always think, tomorrow I will make advancement. And how do I don't get puffed up when I'm engaging in devotional service? I know I'm making advancement. Prabhupada said, always think tomorrow I will make advancement. So that there's hope, but at the same time you understand you're not advanced right now. So it's a combination of humility and hopefulness. And that when we discuss it, when we try to intellectualize it, it doesn't really work because humility, you know, it's funny, I do a lot of teaching, and I do a lot of PowerPoint work in order to use in my teaching. And so I'm often looking for images to visualize concepts. And if you look humility up and try to find images that depict humility or even understand what humility is, you get stuff like doormat and people getting stepped on and people getting... It's not, in most cases, unless you go to a Christian area... Humility is not considered a virtue in our society. Humility is the loser's way they think. So we're on a totally different wavelength. And that humility that we need to cultivate means that we need to think, what hope is there for me? All I can do is hold on to the lotus feet of my Guru Maharaj and Krishna. That's all I can do, because I have no other qualification. I don't even have the qualification in not being qualified. And then the concept that humility means not thinking of yourself or less of yourself, but thinking of yourself less. So then put your consciousness to thinking about how to save others. Don't worry about your humility. It'll come by itself.